Robin Wall Kimmer's The Service Berry has become something of a quiet revolution in environmental literature circles. This slim volume by the MacArthur Genius Fellow and best-selling author of Braiding Sweetgrass has been embraced by sustainability advocates, economists, and spiritual seekers alike. Oprah Winfrey reportedly keeps copies to give to friends, while climate activist Greta Thunberg cited it in a speech about reimagining our relationship with nature. The book's influence extends beyond environmental circles. Several Fortune 500 companies have incorporated its principles into their sustainability frameworks, and universities across four continents use it in courses ranging from economics to indigenous studies. What makes this work so compelling is Kimmerer's unique ability to weave indigenous wisdom, botanical knowledge, and economic theory into a narrative that feels both ancient and urgently modern, a story about berries that somehow contains the seeds of our collective future. The humble service berry goes by many names: Juneberry, Shadbush, Shadblow, Sugarplum, Sarvis, each revealing something about its deep cultural significance across North America. These names aren't just labels, but stories. Shadbush signals when shadfish run upstream to spawn, while Sarvis marked when mountain roads became passable enough for circuit preachers to resume their services after winter's isolation. Indigenous peoples have long recognized this plant as a faithful calendar keeper, its blooms and fruits marking the rhythm of seasons more reliably than any human-made schedule. From the earliest spring blossoms to the deep purple fruits of summer, the serviceberry has served as nature's timepiece for countless generations. The serviceberry's reliability extends beyond its timing. It's a remarkably adaptable plant found from coast to coast, from forest edges to urban parks. In early spring, its delicate white flowers emerge just as the last frost retreats, providing crucial early nectar for pollinators. By June, these same branches hang heavy with fruit, feeding not only humans, but also birds, bears, and dozens of other species that depend on this seasonal bounty. What makes these berries extraordinary isn't just their timing, but their taste. Wild and complex, like blueberry crossed with apple, touched with hints of rosewater and almond from their seeds. This is a flavor profile no grocery store can replicate, a taste that connects us directly to place and season. The berries themselves transform as they ripen, shifting from red to deep purple-black, each stage offering different notes of sweetness and complexity. When you bite into a serviceberry, you're experiencing something that cannot be mass-produced or shipped across continents, a taste that speaks of specific soils, weather patterns, and ecological relationships. In Potawatomi language, serviceberry is called bozakman, literally the best of berries. This name reveals something profound about indigenous relationships with plants. The root min appears in many plant names, but also means gift, acknowledging that plants offer their bounty unconditionally. This linguistic connection isn't coincidental, but reflects a worldview where gratitude forms the foundation of human-plant relationships. Traditional ecological knowledge teaches that these plants are our oldest teachers, offering lessons about timing, patience, and the cyclical nature of life. Have you ever considered what it means to receive food as a gift rather than a commodity? When we purchase berries in plastic clamshells at the supermarket, we participate in a transaction. But when we gather serviceberries from a wild bush, we're receiving a gift that requires no payment, only gratitude and perhaps reciprocity. This shift in perspective changes everything about our relationship with food and the natural world. The serviceberry reminds us that abundance isn't about endless supply, but about seasonal gifts shared widely and freely among all members of the ecological community. Each handful of berries represents not just sustenance, but a connection to land, season, and the countless generations who have gathered these fruits before us. The concept of gratitude in indigenous cultures goes far beyond saying thank you. It's a profound recognition that our very existence depends on Mother Earth's generosity. Those service berries represent countless exchanges, from soil microbes to pollinators to human cultivators, that create an abundance where everyone's needs are met. This isn't mere sentimentality, but a practical philosophy that sustained communities for thousands of years. Indigenous cultures organized their entire economies around this gratitude, understanding that taking without appreciation brings consequences. The Potawatomi and other Indigenous nations recognized that resources weren't limitless and that humans had responsibilities toward maintaining ecological balance. Their economies weren't based on maximizing extraction, but on ensuring continuity, making sure that what was taken could be renewed. What would happen if we applied this principle to our modern economy? Imagine recognizing enoughness through gratitude rather than always seeking more. This perspective offers a potential antidote to hyperconsumption, addressing both climate catastrophe and biodiversity loss at their roots. When we feel grateful for what we have, the compulsion to acquire more diminishes. Consider how different your relationship with food might be if you approached each meal with genuine gratitude, not just for the farmers and cooks, but for the soil, water, sunlight, and countless organisms that made it possible. This gratitude naturally extends to how we treat these systems. We don't pollute what we're grateful for. We don't exhaust what we recognize as precious. The Indigenous concept of the honorable harvest embodies this approach. Take only what you need, use everything you take, minimize harm, and give something back. These principles weren't enforced by external authorities, but were internalized as moral obligations. Breaking these principles meant betraying not just the community, but the very sources of life itself. Gratitude and reciprocity form the foundation of what anthropologists call a gift economy, a system that predates modern market economies and continues to operate alongside them. When receiving gifts like service berries, we can reciprocate through direct actions, weeding, watering, singing thanks, harvesting mindfully, or indirect ones, supporting land trusts, advocating for preservation, reducing carbon footprints, teaching others about ecological stewardship. These exchanges multiply with every interaction, creating renewable abundance through circulation rather than accumulation, much like ripples expanding outward in a pond. Unlike the bilateral transactions of commerce, I give you money, you give me berries, end of story, gift reciprocity keeps moving diffusely through communities in complex networks of exchange. When I receive service berries and make jam to share with neighbors, those neighbors might later help tend the berry patch, teach children about foraging, or pass along different gifts entirely, from garden vegetables to childcare to traditional knowledge. The circulation never ends, and the community strengthens with each exchange, building resilient social networks that can withstand challenges and celebrate abundance together. This pattern mirrors how materials cycle in nature's economy. Carbon moves from atmosphere to berry to bird to soil and back again, creating abundance through circular recycling. Energy flows one way from the sun, but gets transformed and passed along in countless forms through photosynthesis, decomposition, and regeneration. Nothing is wasted. Everything contributes to the system's vitality. Even fallen leaves become soil, feeding future generations of plants. Our current economic system often produces through destruction: extract, manufacture, use, discard, creating waste at every step. But alternatives exist all around us in both human and natural communities. Feminist economists remind us that we all begin life in what they call a maternal gift economy, where mothers freely give sustenance, care, and nurturing without expectation of payment. Similarly, Mother Earth's gifts could be understood through this lens of unconditional giving that builds community rather than mere commodity exchange. Indigenous cultures worldwide have long practiced gift economies that recognize and honor these relationships with the land. Think about the most meaningful gifts you've received. Their value likely had little to do with monetary worth and everything to do with relationship and context. The same service berry might be worth $5 at a farmer's market, but becomes priceless when picked by a child for their parent or when shared during a community harvest celebration. A handful of berries given in friendship carry stories, traditions, and connections that no price tag can capture. The difference isn't in the berry, but in the relationship it represents and the web of reciprocity it helps weave. This gift economy perspective invites us to reimagine wealth not as what we accumulate and hold, but as what circulates and grows through sharing. When we receive nature's gifts with gratitude and pass them on this generosity, we participate in an ancient and enduring economy of relationship and reciprocity. In a service-berry economy, gifts circulate through community, creating relationships and accountability. When we view Earth's offerings as gifts rather than commodities, we become more responsible for their care. This moral sense is violated when resources like water are treated as property to be bought and sold. Our economic systems have commoditized everything from seeds to human attention, creating artificial scarcity instead of abundance and promoting accumulation rather than sharing. Did you know that ecology and economy share the Greek root oikos, meaning home? Both describe systems that sustain life, yet they've become disconnected in modern thinking. In gift economies, these concepts remain unified. Wealth means having enough to share, and abundance is meant to be given away. As one indigenous hunter explained when asked why he didn't store excess meat, "I store my meat in the belly of my brother." This profound statement reveals a completely different understanding of security. In capitalist economies, security comes from individual accumulation. In gift economies, it comes from strong community bonds. If I ensure my neighbor has enough, they'll do the same for me when our situations reverse. In such systems, status comes from generosity rather than accumulation. The currency is relationship, expressed through gratitude and reciprocity, where all flourishing is mutual. This principle operates in traditional ceremonies like Potawatomi giveaways and Pacific Northwest potlatches, ceremonial feasts where possessions are given away with lavish generosity. These practices enhance the giver's prestige while affirming connections with a web of relations. Colonial governments banned potlatches in the 1800s, seeing them as contrary to civilized values of accumulation and undermining notions of individual property. These traditional values continue in contemporary indigenous economics. Dr. Ronald Trosper has documented how making good relationships with human and more than human worlds remains the primary currency of well-being, shaping tribal economic agreements from timber to salmon. The historic intertribal agreements to protect Bear's Ears as the first tribally focused national monument exemplifies this approach, a collaboration based on shared responsibility rather than resource extraction. The gift economy exists all around us in everyday life, hiding in plain sight amid our transaction-based world. My neighbor Sandy places surplus garden produce and flowers on a card table with a free sign. Zucchini, notorious for their abundance, become part of a neighborhood exchange system where people share their surplus rather than waste it. This practice spreads contagiously along country roads, with others setting up their own giveaway tables. These small acts form a genuine economy, a system of redistributing wealth based on abundance and the joy of sharing. As Rebecca Solnit describes in A Paradise Built in Hell, gift economies surge up spontaneously during disasters when human survival is threatened. People pool resources, share freely, and form networks of mutual aid when market economies are disrupted. Hurricane Sandy in New York, the 2011 earthquake in Japan, even the COVID-19 pandemic all revealed our latent capacity for mutual aid. The challenge is cultivating this capacity without requiring catastrophe. Modern economic theory assumes we'll all behave as Adam Smith's rational economic man, greedy, isolated individuals acting purely in self-interest. Yet abundant evidence shows humans lean toward cooperation and generosity when not coerced otherwise. What if we designed systems for the empathic mutualist human instead? Gift economies flourish in various forms today: free cycling networks, repair cafes, campus free stores, clothing swaps, and the Buy Nothing movement. Digital gift economies include open source software, Wikipedia, and instructional videos where people share knowledge freely. These grassroots innovations resist destructive economic systems by creating alternatives founded on protecting what we love, emulating the gift economies of plants. Have you participated in any of these alternative economies? Perhaps you've contributed to Wikipedia, shared garden surplus, or joined a tool library. These aren't just nice gestures. They're the building blocks of a different economic system operating alongside the market economy. Each time we choose to give rather than sell, to share rather than hoard, we strengthen these alternative networks. We live in what economists call a mixed economy, rather than a purely free market one. Entrepreneurs face regulations, and there's a mixture of private and public goods. The question isn't whether gift economies can replace capitalism entirely, but how they can thrive within this mix, addressing needs that markets fail to meet. Gift economies are everywhere when we pay attention. Friends share dinner or pass along baby items. I receive books and pass them on when finished. This simple act is the atom of a gift economy. No money changes hands, nothing goes to landfill, and the giving creates bonds of reciprocity, much like what service berries do naturally. Rather than scaling up gift economies, perhaps we should appreciate their inherent small-scale nature. The Little Free Library movement exemplifies this. Wooden boxes outside churches and homes filled with books flowing freely between neighbors. Public libraries represent gift economies at civic scale, embodying common property where books belong to everyone, requiring only respect for the shared resource. Libraries, parks, and public spaces are common resources funded by pooled tax dollars. Though we grumble about taxes, they're investments in collective care. Nordic cuddly capitalism extends this model to healthcare, education, and sustainability, resulting in higher happiness despite higher taxation. The inherent challenge with gift economies is vulnerability to those who violate trust. When someone took an entire farm stand, not just the produce, it demonstrated how excess taking can derail sharing systems. This relates to the tragedy of the commons theory, which has justified privatizing shared resources. However, Eleanor Ostrom's Nobel Prize-winning work proved that collective action, trust, and cooperation can sustain commonly held resources without degradation, challenging economic orthodoxy with a model that botanists can appreciate. What commons do you participate in? Perhaps you enjoy public parks, benefit from open-source software, or rely on community knowledge. These resources function because people contribute without direct compensation, understanding that the whole system benefits everyone. When we recognize these commons as valuable, we're more likely to protect and expand them. When we view Earth as merely a warehouse of commodities, we claim privilege to exploit what we believe we own. This property mindset removes moral constraints on consumption, leading to ecological and spiritual depletion. But in a worldview where land is gift and the givers are someones, not somethings, we face a moral dilemma. As humans who lack photosynthesis, we must consume, but our overconsumption has brought us to disaster's edge. What would it mean to consume with awareness that we're receiving unearned earthly gifts? To consume with humility? The Honorable Harvest Guidelines are rarely written down, but reinforced through daily acts. Know the ways of those who take care of you, so you can care for them. Introduce yourself and be accountable as one asking for life. Ask permission before taking and respect the answer. Never take the first one or the last. Take only what you need and only what is given. Never take more than half, leaving some for others. Harvest with minimal harm. Use what you take respectfully, never wasting. Share. Give thanks for what you've received. Give gifts in reciprocity for what you've taken. Sustain those who sustain you, and the earth will last forever. These principles apply beyond wild harvesting. Imagine applying them to shopping. Would you buy that shirt if you knew the true ecological cost? Would you waste food if you recognized it as a gift rather than a commodity? The Honorable Harvest offers a framework for ethical consumption applicable to modern life. The challenge isn't just personal choices, but systemic change. How do we build economic systems that embody these principles? How do we shift from exploitation to reciprocity at scale? These questions require both individual action and collective reimagining of our economic foundations. I lament my immersion in an economy that grinds beauty into dollars, converting gifts to commodities we don't need while destroying what we do. Service berries show us another model based on reciprocity rather than accumulation, where wealth comes from relationships, not self-sufficiency. The intricate dance between service berries, pollinators, and seed dispersers demonstrates this perfectly. Without gift relationships with bees and birds, service berries would disappear. Even hoarding abundance atop the wealth ladder wouldn't save them from extinction if their partners didn't share in that abundance. The berries must be eaten to spread. The nutrients must cycle through the ecosystem. Hoarding won't save us either. All flourishing is mutual. In the service berries gift economy, abundance is stored in the belly of my brother. This indigenous wisdom manifests in how service berries support entire food webs. Birds feast on berries, spreading seeds across landscapes while depositing natural fertilizer. Supporting thriving bird communities benefits everyone in the food chain, from soil microorganisms to apex predators. This interconnected support system is especially important for immobile beings like trees who can't escape broken relationships. The success of service berries depends on maintaining robust networks of mutually beneficial relationships. Thriving requires nurturing strong community bonds across species boundaries. As a plant ecologist, I wonder if natural systems could be understood as economic analogs. Could biomimicry help us design exchange systems benefiting both humans and more than humans? Ecological economists like Valerie Luzzatis believe so, seeking to build systems that meet needs while aligning with ecological principles for long-term sustainability. They study how nature creates closed-loop systems where waste becomes food and resources are shared efficiently. Our current system makes us self-identify as consumers before ecosystem citizens, encouraging extraction over regeneration. Service berry teaches interdependence and co-evolution, the heart of ecological economics. Over millions of years, the berries evolved to attract specific animals, developing precise sugar content, color, and ripening times. It offers a model based on gratitude and reciprocity rather than scarcity. As someone schooled by plants with berry-stained fingers, I question scarcity's primacy in human economics. The natural world demonstrates abundance when relationships are honored. Gift economies arise from understanding earthly abundance and the gratitude it generates. Even ecologists are reevaluating competition as evolution's primary force. When the focus shifts from individuals to groups, cooperation proves better for thriving. Studies of forest ecosystems reveal vast underground networks where trees share resources and information. As Richard Powers notes, you cannot compete in a zero-sum game with creatures upon whom your existence depends. Service berries discovered this long ago. Their success comes from fostering mutually beneficial relationships rather than competing for resources. Humans need to catch up and redesign our economic systems to reflect these ecological truths. The threat of real scarcity comes from unbridled capitalism, where extraction and consumption outstrip Earth's capacity to replenish. An economy based on ever-expanding growth leads to nightmare scenarios, an engine of extinction. While struggling with how service berries and gift economies might offer alternatives to capitalism, I received a timely invitation from my neighbor Polly to pick service berries for free at her farm. Though Polly planted the orchard as a revenue stream, she chose to invite neighbors to pick freely. Despite her investment costs, trees, tilling, irrigation, she transformed the berries from commodity to gift. Polly explains this isn't pure altruism. An investment in community always comes back to you. The gift builds relationships, and that's what we really produce here. Free berries might translate to better sales later as people return to a place they feel connected to. Even when something is purchased as a commodity, the gift of relationship remains attached. This reciprocity extends beyond transactions into a web of social capital. Being known as a citizen is always a value, Polly notes, creating goodwill that cushions community relationships. Without good neighbors, you'd be alone, and that's worse. Customers who value farm experiences might even vote for farmland preservation later, a meaningful return on free berries. The gift economy offers escape from the grinding system that commodifies everything while leaving us bereft of belonging, relationship, purpose, and beauty. Though anthropologists note gift economies function best in small communities, we could intentionally create such interdependent webs outside the market economy. The local food movement isn't just about freshness and carbon footprints. It's about our deep desire for connection and reciprocity. Market capitalism won't vanish, but we can nurture parallel gift economies that provide what we truly crave, face-to-face relationships, and being valued for our unique contributions. As Charles Eisenstein writes in Sacred Economics, mature economies mirror nature's interdependency, cooperation, and resource cycling. Money may not disappear anytime soon, but it will serve a diminished role. The economy will shrink, and our lives will grow. How do we transition to a new system? Ecological succession provides guidance. Plant communities constantly change through incremental replacement and creative disruption. Pioneer species behave like colonizers, me, 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 consuming resources without regard for the future, but eventually exhaust themselves and create conditions for more sustainable communities. The mature species that follow grow slowly, foster cooperation, and invest in persistence. We need both incremental change and creative disruption to transform our culture. The edges where new and old economies meet are like ecological ecotones, diverse, productive, and filled with berries and birds. This is the realm of service berries. The extractive capitalist economy is a crime against nature, propelling mass extinction and human suffering. But there's hope in the quiet revolution of neighbors creating common spaces, sharing berry patches, and building relationships. Regenerative economies that reciprocate Earth's gifts are our only path forward.